Welcome to Prostate Cancer Uncensored, a podcast produced by Zero Prostate Cancer. I'm Dr. Reggie Tucker Seeley, Zero's Vice President of Health Equity, and I'm joined today by Mr. Eric Morrow, a prostate cancer survivor that I had the privilege of meeting at Zero's 2023 Prostate Cancer Summit in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining me today, Eric.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Reggie.
So, Eric, you and I recently had a conversation about your prostate cancer journey, and I think there's many aspects of your story that for the folks listening, they're going to definitely relate to. And then similar to others, there's several aspects of your story that are unique to you. So I'm eager for our listeners to hear that story. But first, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, such as where you're from originally and your family background?
Sure, Reggie. So I was raised in the greater Los Angeles area. And my father and my mother met as graduate students at UCLA. Much like President Obama, my father's from Kenya and received a fellowship to study here in the United States in the late 60s. And my mother's family immigrated to the U.S. from Great Britain, Ireland, and the Netherlands back in the 1600s to early 1800s. And my father returned to Kenya when I was about 5 years old. So he left my mother and I. And I was raised by my mom and her side of the family. And I didn't really have any contact with my father until I was about 20 years old when we reconnected. And that'll come into play a little bit later when we talk about family history.
Okay, great. And nice to hear about a fellow Angelino, because I'm currently based in Los Angeles. So I recall that you shared with me in our previous conversation your work background in the healthcare field. So can you also share a little bit about your professional background to give our listeners a good understanding about where you were in life when your prostate cancer journey started? And can you share with our listeners a little bit about your work background?
Absolutely. So after high school, I attended the United States Air Force Academy, and then I spent 20 years on active duty as an Air Force officer. And during my 2 decades in the military, I deployed multiple times to the Middle East, so Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Jordan, and of course, Iraq. And once I reached 20 years of service, I decided to retire from the Air Force, and I started working for a medical device distributorship here in the Washington, D.C. area. Basically, my job was to sell surgical implants, so spinal fixation devices, donated human bone and tendons, and other medical technologies. And then if a doctor decided that they wanted to purchase those for a particular surgery, my job was to go to the surgery and provide support to that surgeon and the OR nurses and make sure that the technology functioned properly and that I was there to troubleshoot anything if any issues came up. And I think that experience really gave me a unique perspective on healthcare because I was able to kind of, you know, get behind the curtain and be in the OR, talk to surgeons, talk to nurses, and it really helped me out once I was diagnosed with prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm eager to hear more about sort of how that background in healthcare informed your navigation of the healthcare delivery system. But before we get there, I'd also like to talk a little bit about prostate cancer screening. So the guidelines around when to get screened for prostate cancer can be, you know, a bit confusing. Some guidelines state that men shouldn't get screened until their 50s, but state that if one is high risk, then that screening should happen earlier. So let's say around age 40, where high risk refers to men who are African American or those who have a first degree relative who's been diagnosed. And so prior to your diagnosis, were you aware of those guidelines? And if not, what did you know about prostate cancer screening guidelines?
Sure. So I didn't know much about prostate cancer before my diagnosis. I knew that my grandfather, my mother's father, had developed prostate cancer late in his life, in his late 70s. And I disclosed that to my providers during my annual physicals. So sort of as an aside, during my military career, I was required to have a physical exam every year. So from 18 when I started at the Air Force Academy until 42 when I got out of the Air Force, every year you had to go get a physical. And if you didn't get one, then you got in trouble. So I didn't want to get in trouble. I always made sure to get my physical. And I just continued that go get a physical every year after my retirement. Now I mentioned my father and I reconnected when I was about 20 years old, and we weren't in close contact, I guess I'd say, because he was still living in Kenya, and so it was sort of a, you know, once twice a year kind of thing where we'd talk on the phone or eventually exchange emails. And then I actually went back to Kenya for one of my sister's weddings when I was about 45. And at that point in time, I learned that my father was being treated for prostate cancer and that he'd been diagnosed in his mid-60s. So I added that information to my history form and discussed it with my providers, and they assured me that PSA testing wasn't necessary until I was 50, since my father didn't de develop the disease until his mid-60s. And, you know, honestly, I wish I'd educated myself better, but I trusted that my providers, you know, the people with medical degrees, knew more about the subject and were providing me the best guidance regarding cancer screening. Now, unfortunately, I've since learned, and I think a lot of primary care providers don't know about the need for early screening for high-risk groups for prostate cancer and simply base their screening recommendations off of the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, or USPSTF, guidelines. And those guidelines don't take high-risk groups like African American men, veterans, or men with a family history into account. And I happen to be in all three of those high-risk groups, by the way.
Yeah, and so you know those guidelines can be very confusing, and like you said, you know, if your primary care doctor is trying to follow the United States Preventive Services Task Force guidelines, that says, you know, age 50, again, unless you're in one of those high-risk groups, and you happen to be in all three, you know, three of those high-risk groups that you just mentioned. So, you know, we often hear that lack of access to primary care is a is one of the primary drivers of differences in prostate cancer outcomes from screening to treatment throughout survivorship between white men and racial and ethnic minority men. However, you had access to what might be considered really good health care, and you weren't screened, even though you had a family history. So can you tell our listeners a bit about how you came to be screened for prostate cancer? Did your primary care doctor finally recommend it, you know, sort of after you sort of realized you were in these high-risk groups, or did you ask for prostate cancer screening? Can you tell us a little bit more about that process?
Sure. So, no, my primary care provider did not recommend it. At my annual physical in September of 2020, I again mentioned my family history, my father and my maternal grandfather, and asked if I should get a PSA test. And the doctor, who's actually an African American female, didn't even really pause to consider the question and pretty confidently told me PSA screening wasn't recommended until age 50, based on when my father was diagnosed, and I trusted her. However, she did put in a referral for a colonoscopy because the USPSTF had recently changed their recommendations for that test from 50 down to age 45, and I was now age 49. So it was about 4 months between my physical and my colonoscopy, just based on availability of the OR and the provider. And when it was finished, that doctor, an endoscopist, informed me that my colon looked great, but my prostate was a little enlarged and said, you know, maybe you should see a urologist about it. And again, it didn't sound super urgent, but he followed up about a month later to check and see if I'd scheduled my appointment. And that endoscopist probably saved my life because that recommendation resulted in me going to a urologist and ultimately getting my prostate cancer diagnosis.
Wow, that is such an unusual, you know, route for this for your prostate cancer to sort of, you know, sort of start the process towards diagnosis. A lot of men may be apprehensive or, you know, nervous about being screened for prostate cancer, and especially if that screening includes the digital rectal exam. So what is your message to any man right now that might be hesitant about being screened for prostate cancer?
Sure. I guess I'd say, what's more important, your modesty or your life? And, in all seriousness, a DRE, the digital rectal exam, is a medical exam. There's absolutely nothing sexual about it. And it typically only takes a few seconds. And I know a lot of men are squeamish about it, and we all joke about it and everything. It's a little bit invasive, but it's far less invasive than an annual women's health exam. And they typically start getting those in their later teen years, every year. So I'm not a medical professional. I can't offer medical advice, but my personal opinion is that high-risk groups should absolutely start getting an annual PSA test and a DRE beginning at age 40, or possibly even earlier if there's a family history of early onset prostate cancer.
So in the screening and healthcare research and practice, there's often this discussion around shared decision making, where shared decision making, refers to this notion that, you're going to make the decision with your primary care doctor. And, we don't want to, sort of, bash the primary care profession for following, clinical guidelines. But in this instance, that didn't really feel like a shared decision was being made there.
No. She definitely kind of pushed it off and said I didn't need it, which is surprising. And as we've discussed, some primary care providers are well informed about prostate cancer and others aren't. And that means it's really up to us to talk with our providers, be our own best advocates, and really have a discussion about what we, the patient, want and need. And I'm living proof that we as men need to do a better job of talking about family medical histories, medical issues, and just educating each other about what's required to keep ourselves healthy. And then we need to engage our doctors and make sure that our concerns aren't waved away. Again, a DRE is a quick process, and it's the only way for a doctor to physically examine the prostate. Similarly, a PSA test is a relatively inexpensive blood test, and it really comes down to a mindset change. When I was a kid, I grew up sort of thinking, hey, the doctor's in charge. And ultimately, the doctor isn't in charge of our healthcare. He's a trusted advisor and consultant, but we need to own our healthcare and insist on what we feel is best for us.
I really like that reframe. That is thinking about, our physicians as trusted advisors and consultants to our healthcare. They're not necessarily, in charge of our healthcare. And one of the things that we often talk a lot about on our health equity team here at Zero is the importance of the healthcare delivery system, being a trusted partner to Black men as we're navigating the healthcare delivery system.
I think I'd almost say, much like it, when you're doing your taxes, you see a CPA, but ultimately you're responsible for your return. And if
Yes.
there's a problem, you're going to get audited. In that same refrain, the doctor's the medical expert, you're getting his advice and expertise, but then you need to do what you think is best and you need to keep asking for what you think is best if the doctor initially pushes you off and says you don't need it.
Yes. And as someone who has a background in accounting, I can definitely, sort of appreciate the notion of, the person coming prepared, for that discussion, around their taxes. I think one of the things that is a significant part of what keeps men from getting screened is not knowing what the process will entail and then what happens after screening. So I should mention that, current clinical best practices around screening for prostate cancer include the PSA test or the prostate-specific antigen test, the digital rectal exam, and an MRI. So, can you share what happened to you following your screening and then getting diagnosed with prostate cancer? In particular, when and where you were diagnosed and how old you were at the time?
Sure. So at the time of my diagnosis, I was 49 years old, about a month shy of my 50th birthday, and I was living here in the Washington, D.C. area. As a military retiree, I can still get my care through the Department of Defense, and my primary care is at Andrews Air Force Base, which is also now called Joint Base Andrews. And that's also where I had my initial urology appointment and my screening. So when I saw the urologist, he initially offered an MRI as the primary diagnostic tool, but I knew that could take a while to schedule since most radiology departments typically have about a month-long wait for appointments. So after some additional conversation with me, he recommended a digital rectal exam and a PSA blood test. So he performed the DRE. Mentioned that my prostate seemed a little abnormal, but that it wasn't necessarily something to worry about. And then he sent me down to the lab for a blood draw. He didn't seem overly concerned, so I wasn't either at that point in time. So then I did the blood draw. I spent a little bit of more time on base, and then I started driving home. And I was actually in the car when he called with the results of my PSA blood test. And I still remember, he said 225, which didn't mean anything to me until he explained that anything over 4 was concerning and that he wanted me to come back the following week for a biopsy. So the biopsy itself was also a relatively straightforward process. I laid on a table on my side, and the doctor used an ultrasound device to target my prostate and remove several cores. Now, again, if you think about a DRE, the biopsy is a little more invasive because they put the device into your rectum and then go through the rectum into the prostate to remove the samples. So each core removal was accompanied by a loud click, and there was some pain associated with it, but not too much. I drove myself home, took Tylenol for probably about 24 hours after the biopsy, and then I also had blood in my stool the evening after the procedure, and I had blood in my urine probably for 5 or 6 days afterward.
So do you feel like that process was adequately, explained to you, sort of, what you were going to have to go through?
Yes. Now,
Okay.
again, this is where having been in sort of the healthcare world professionally for the last decade, I've gotten really comfortable with talking about medical stuff, and I've gotten, very comfortable talking to doctors that are, much more educated than me, but I can kind of speak the same language. I always kind of joke that I'm not a doctor, but I can play one on TV. And so what I do before any procedure that I'm unfamiliar with is I basically say, "Hey doc, can you talk me through the procedure like I'm a medical student so that I can understand what's going to happen?" And they're generally very willing to do that. Most doctors like to teach. And so it's a way for me to become familiar with what's going to happen and either know what to expect or, as is the case with surgery, you're unconscious, so you're not following along with the procedure, but it still is a way for me to mentally prepare for it.
Yes. Yeah, I think, a big part of, the sort of uncertainty or scariness about the process is that, and I'll only speak for myself, I do not like surprises. So I think, sort of having, the process explained to me so that I know what to expect, I think that can be really helpful to for a lot of men who may view, navigating preventive care and, the additional follow-up can feel very overwhelming. So can you tell our listeners what your process was like receiving your prostate cancer diagnosis and then, having to navigate the treatment decision process?
Sure. So the week after my biopsy on Tuesday, June the 8th, the results came back. Now, I'm an impatient guy, and I made the cardinal sin of going online to check and see if the biopsy results were there instead of waiting for the doctor to call me. Because again, as part of the Department of Defense, I have access to, all of my test results online, and I think most of us do nowadays. And so I went online. It was after work hours. It's probably about, 5:30 or 6 in the evening. And the biopsy results were there, and I looked at them, and I was really stunned to see the results in black and white. And again, a lot of it didn't make sense to me. It said, 13 of 17 cores positive, Gleason 9, 5 plus 4, and 2 of 2, Gleason 9, 4 plus 5, and 3 of 3, Gleason 7, 4 plus 3, and 6 of 10, Gleason 7, 3 plus 4, and 2 of 2. And I didn't know what any of that meant. And then I saw, intraductal carcinoma and perineural invasion both identified. So I spent the next few minutes Googling Gleason score, figured out that I had aggressive prostate cancer. And then I went and showed my wife the report and just almost wordlessly handed it to her and said, biopsy results came back in. And she did the same thing. She kind of looked at it and says, "What does this mean?" And I said, "I have prostate cancer." And she was shocked and scared as well. And I don't think either one of us slept very well that night. So the urology clinic normally opens at 8 a.m. I called at 7:30 the next morning and got through to one of the technicians. The doctor was out of the office, but he called a few minutes, probably about 30 minutes later. He informed me that he made an appointment for me the following Monday. So this was a Wednesday, and he said, basically, yes, you have prostate cancer. I made an appointment for you on Monday, and please bring your wife, and we'll talk about everything then. And he also told me that I should schedule a head, chest, and abdomen CT and a full body bone scan as soon as possible to rule out metastatic disease, and that he was putting it in as a stat order. So I hung up with him. I called the radiology department at Joint Base Andrews, and they initially told me they didn't have an opening until late July. And I informed them that my doctor had said it was urgent and that he'd put in a stat order, and there was a pause on the line, and I could hear the technician typing. And then he asked if I could come in at 10 a.m. that day. So, of course, I said yes. And then the same thing happened when I called nuclear medicine at Fort Belvoir Community Hospital to schedule the bone scan. Joint Base Andrews doesn't have a nuclear medicine department, so I had to go down to that hospital for the bone scan. We're really lucky here in the DC area. We have actually four major military treatment facilities. So, with the number of active duty military and retirees here in DC, they have a number of hospitals, and not every specialty is at every hospital. So I called nuclear medicine at Fort Belvoir, and this time they didn't have an open appointment until early August. So again, I explained my situation, said the doctor said it's stat, and she said, "I'll call you back in an hour." And she called me back in 45 minutes, told me that I had an appointment on Friday. And so I went to both of those appointments, and basically, they have you lie on a table. They put some they have some IV medicine that they put into you to provide a little bit extra contrast for the CT or the bone scan. And then there's like a big thing around you that you slide back and forth in, and they measure stuff. And fortunately, both scans came back clean, so no detectable metastases, and that was a huge relief for me because, I was thinking, man, if anything over 4 is bad for PSA, and I have 225, is this in my bones? Is it in my organs? How long am I going to live? And that's I hadn't yet learned much, and that was my fear is like, hey, I'm gonna die, and I'm gonna die soon. And I think that's a common fear of a lot of people when they hear cancer. It's not necessarily always the case. And there's a lot of treatments for prostate cancer that can slow down disease progression, or if it's caught early enough, potentially be curative. But I didn't know that at the time. So the following Monday, my wife and I met with the urologist there at Joint Base Andrews to discuss my diagnosis. And he, discussed treatment options as we understood them at that point, basically surgery or radiotherapy. The urologist didn't really push one treatment or the other. He just briefly discussed each one, the pros and cons of each one, and explained that the 5-year survival statistics for each were about the same. And again, it was super overwhelming. And I'm thinking to myself, 5 years? That's, you know, the I'm like, I want more than 5 years. Don't tell me 5 years. Give me the 20-year survival statistics. And so then he spoke a little bit more about surgery, benefits and potential side effects, and recommended I schedule a consult with radiation oncology down at Fort Belvoir to get their perspective on radiotherapy before I made a treatment decision. So again, it was super overwhelming. You know, there I was, not quite 50, about to close on a new house, as a matter of fact. We were about a week away from closing on our house, and I was being told that I had an aggressive cancer. I will say one of the things I'm really thankful for is that my wife came to the appointment, and that provided a lot of peace of mind for both of us. One, you know, it wasn't something where I had to remember everything and then tell her. We could both hear it together. And, you know, I think each of us, we compared our notes afterwards, and each one of us keyed in on slightly different things. And
So you both
so
were complimentary.
we were both complimentary, we were both taking notes, and really probably for the first, oh, 9 months or so of treatment, my wife came to almost every appointment, and she was the scribe. And so I could sit and, you know, engage and listen to the clinicians, and she could take notes. And if she thought of additional questions, she could ask additional questions too. And we were always on the same page as far as what our options were, and you know, what was going to happen going forward. So at that point in the in the opinion in the appointment, I asked the doctor about second opinions. You know, everyone always says ask for a second opinion, and you know, it in my mind, it wasn't even so much like do I have cancer or not, because the biopsy was pretty conclusive, and you know, the PSA score, biopsy, everything together, you know, there really wasn't any doubt in my mind that I had cancer. I was really asking for second opinions about treatment. And I said, you know, is there anyone else I can talk to? And the urologist said, you know, oh, you know, Walter Reed, sort of the military's flagship hospital, has a Center for Prostate Disease Research, and I'll try to refer you there. And so again, I think every hospital in DC has urologists. The only urologic oncologist, so the urologist that deals specifically with cancers, with urological cancers, is at Walter Reed. So, you know, the urologist at Andrews also explained that the CPDR, the Center for Prostate Disease Research, ran a multidisciplinary clinic. So when patients went to go see them for their initial consult, they had an opportunity to discuss care with multiple specialties. And, you know, again, I knew Walter Reed was the DoD's Cancer Center of Excellence. And I'd also heard great things about Dr. Gregory Chestnut, their urologic oncologist, because again, because I'm in the medical industry, if you will, I have some doctors that are not only clients, but also friends. And one of them, when I told him about my diagnosis, specifically said, hey, you should try and see Dr. Chestnut at Walter Reed. So I let my urologist know that I wanted to be seen at the CPDR, and that was really the end of the appointment. He said he'd refer me. My wife and I went home. The urologist called me a couple of days later and let me know that CPDR was taking my case and that they wanted to get a pelvic MRI for a more complete picture of what my prostate looked like. So I went in for an MRI that evening, probably about 7 p.m. And my urologist called me. I think that was a Wednesday. And my urologist called me the following Saturday to let me know that the MRI showed that cancer had spread to my seminal vesicles and pelvic lymph nodes. So again, at that point in time, I got pretty scared because I'm like, oh, lymph nodes, and I, again, not being super smart on cancer, I'd heard, once it gets in your lymph nodes, it goes really, really bad. And so I stressed about things for about a week. And then I went to the multidisciplinary clinic at Walter Reed. And it was an all-day appointment. And I had a chance to meet with all of the members of my care team that morning. So I met with Dr. Chestnut, the urologic oncologist, the surgeon. I met with a radiation oncologist, a urologist that focused on sexual health, a patient educator, their clinic coordinator, a clinical social worker or therapist. And, she actually said, again, prostate cancer is one of those things that you as a patient are dealing with, but cancer can affect the whole family and the stress that it puts on the family. And, prostate cancer, because it is a reproductive cancer, can put additional stressors on a couple. So she basically said, I'm here for you. I will see you. I will see your wife. I will see your children. And if you and your wife want to come and see me together for couples counseling, I'll do that too. And that was fantastic. I also met with a genetics counselor, clinical researchers, and a specialist I've never heard of before called a urodynamicist. And basically, she's a nurse that deals specifically with incontinence and pelvic floor therapy. And then I also received a referral to meet with a dietitian. So all of that happened that first morning. And, really provided me with a lot of peace of mind that that Walter Reed and the CPDR really knew what they were doing and was going to put a lot of effort and empathy into my care.
Well, too, it sounds like, you receive the type of care that, we often talk about in terms of, the best kind of care you can get, where the healthcare delivery system really just takes all of its resources and, types of professions and just sort of wraps around the entire family. But before we get there, because I definitely want to talk about that multidisciplinary team, but 2 points, based on the story that you've shared with us so far. So one is, oftentimes, as men, we go to the physician when there's something wrong. And in this instance, prostate cancer doesn't really have any known symptoms. So as you were navigating this, were there any clues that, that something was going on?
No. So prior to my diagnosis, I was completely asymptomatic. Again, if that endoscopist doing my colonoscopy had not said, go see a urologist, it would have been another 9, 10 months before I saw my primary care physician. And at that point, I would have been 50 and I would have gotten the PSA test, and that's how we would have found out. And interestingly, when I explained this whole, story to Dr. Chestnut, one of his comments was, like, it's a great thing that that endoscopist did what he did, because if you'd waited another year, he's like, I can't say for certain, but it's entirely possible that at that point you would have had metastatic bone disease, and we would have been in a very different place treatment-wise.
And then the other point I wanted to raise is the importance of having someone there with you to guide and to sort of, to take the notes when you can't take the notes. And so can you talk a little bit about, how important it was to have that complementary partner there with you as you were navigating it?
Oh, I don't know how I would have navigated all this without my wife. I mean, she is not a medical person. She gets kind of squeamish sometimes when you talk about medical procedures, but I give her full credit that she came to every appointment, kind of, to her best ability, kind of put her emotions aside and, wasn't like getting worried or fearful in the appointment. She was just taking notes, asking questions that I hadn't thought of. A lot of times we'd talk before appointments and I'd say, these are the questions that I have. And she's like, all right, well, if you forget to ask them, I will ask them. And again, because we're, two different people, at the end of any conversation, we may have slightly different views about it. So we were able to go home and review our notes and talk about the appointment and what happened and what we understood the next steps to be, and kind of the what my prognosis was and all of that. And again, having that other person to, even just drive me to and from the appointments, because it was one of those where I was so in the moment that I think I don't know that I would have been as safe to drive after some of these appointments, or even before them, when there's a lot on my mind, as I would probably like to be.
And so I think, equally important to having that, complementary partner, the care that you mentioned that you received at Walter Reed, where you had access to this multidisciplinary care team, this meant that you had a team that, didn't just include your healthcare providers and focusing on your physical health, but also the mental health of you and your family. So why do you think such teams are important and helpful for the treatment of prostate cancer?
Sure. So, dealing with prostate cancer isn't just a surgical or radiation decision. The weight of the diagnosis is it's pretty heavy, and everyone reacts to it a little differently. And I was tremendously comforted to know that my family and I would be able to see a mental health professional, and one that worked exclusively with breast and prostate cancer patients and understood our concerns. I really believe it's important to treat the whole person and not just the disease. Mental stress can result in less sleep, weight loss, and lethargy that ultimately can affect your body's ability to absorb and recover from the physical stress of treatment. And additionally, the stress and fear around cancer can affect your relationships with family and friends. So having the support of those family and friends is critical as you deal with treatment. And finally, your family members are dealing with their own emotional stress, and they may not want to share it with you. They may internalize all that stress because they don't want to add another burden to your load, but they do need an outlet for their concerns. And so it's important for everybody involved, the entire family, to have someone to talk to. And I think the view of mental health has evolved over my lifetime. And really now people, mental health is just health. And so I know some people may be concerned about the stigma of seeing a mental health professional, but there's no stigma. It's just another type of treatment.
Yes, and I think, your statement about whole person care, that is that this, treatment process needs to take into consideration that it's not just treating, the body part that's, under treatment. It is the whole person, including their mental health, but too, not just that person. Their family is managing, so I really appreciate, your comments around, how can the healthcare delivery system really, help not just the patient, but his or her, family as well. So how do you think these kinds of multidisciplinary teams, help to engender trust with our healthcare delivery system?
Well, I think first and foremost, really having an opportunity to engage with both the urologic oncologist and the radiation oncologist on the same day was amazing. They each independently came in, went over my chart, and explained how their treatment worked, listened to my questions and concerns, and then, when we were done with the morning part of the clinic, my wife and I went to lunch, and the entire team, that whole multidisciplinary team, sat down together, discussed my case, and developed a recommendation. So when we returned from lunch, we met with both the urologic oncologist and radiation oncologist together, Both doctors in the same room with me and my wife, and they presented their recommendation for treatment and talked through their rationale. So by the time we finished, I felt like I knew what they wanted to do, why they decided to on that particular plan, and I was 100% on board because, again, I felt like I was a part of the decision, and I didn't feel like I was being shuttled from one place to another. I felt like, we as a team are going to talk about you and come up with what we think is the best possible treatment plan.
Yes. And it sounds more like, that shared decision making that we talked about earlier. When you're presented with the options and you get to make the decision with your care team. So Eric, you mentioned that you received a robot-assisted radical prostatectomy and adjuvant or ADT and external beam radiation therapy. Can you please tell our listeners about that decision-making process to select those treatment options?
Sure. So, simply put, my doctors felt that the triple treatment, if you will, of surgery, ADT, and radiotherapy gave me the best chance at a cure. They were very clear that it might not be curative and that there were no, percentages for how curative it might be. But basically, what they said is, you're young. You're in good shape. Your body can withstand. You have a very aggressive treatment, or sorry, a very aggressive cancer, and we're going to get aggressive right back at it. And, if it's not curative, we think this is going to give you the greatest opportunity for a longer time before recurrence. With stage 3B prostate cancer that had already invaded my lymph nodes, I could have elected against surgery and only done ADT and radiation. And in fact, for typically for less aggressive cancers, the standard of care calls for either ADT or radiation as the primary treatment. So going in with a plan, sorry. Not AT, either surgery or radiation is the primary treatment. And so, going in with all three already pre-planned was pretty unusual. I was concerned that if my prostate wasn't removed, it was going to continue generating cancer cells. And personally, I felt like removal and radiation along with ADT would remove the source of my cancer and treat any diseased lymph nodes or any other tissue that surgery couldn't get. And I knew about all of the side effects. And really, I'd kind of already said, I'm not worried about side effects. My concern is getting as many years as I can, because I had a 18-year-old and a 13-year-old at the time. And I wanted, I'm looking for decades, 20, I'm looking for another 20, 30 years of life. And I wanted the most aggressive treatment to do that. And, ultimately, I think I chose the best treatment for my specific case. And in fact, when my post-op pathology report came back, it indicated that nearly 83% of my prostate was diseased. And both my urologic oncologist and my radiation oncologist commented that due to the volume of cancer in my prostate, radiation alone would have been unlikely to be highly effective.
So first, I want to say I'm grateful with you and your family that you were able to get this, this amazing multidisciplinary treatment team, to work towards you having those decades with your family. But this sounds like a very arduous process in terms of, what you may have been expected to know as you navigated. I often tell folks, I'm a healthcare services, researcher, and I struggle with navigating, the healthcare delivery system. So, as you look back at your experience from, getting screened to diagnosis to treatment to post-treatment, which, you know, what we call cancer survivorship, what do you think that the healthcare delivery system did well? And what could it do better for men navigating this process?
Sure. So, as far as what the delivery system did well, I really can't say enough good things about the CPDR at Walter Reed. It's a fantastic resource for any military member or dependent or retiree out there. In fact, I put it up there with any of the other top cancer centers around the country. And, interestingly, I found out that CPDR is funded by Congress independent of the rest of Walter Reed. So it has its own funding line, and the hospital commander can't take that CPDR money and put it somewhere else. And part of that is just good governance. I hate to be cynical, but part of it is also because members of Congress, cabinet secretaries, Supreme Court justices can also get treated at Walter Reed, and most of those people are men. So, to some extent, they're funding their cancer center of excellence, and I get to benefit from that. The care and contact I had with my treatment team at nearly every step along the way was phenomenal. And I'll share another story with you really quickly. Again, being in the medical industry, I'm always thinking about, like, oh, this is the current treatment. What other technology is out there that could prove that, that might be beneficial? And so back in probably January of last year, I was doing radiation. So I'm in the linear accelerator getting zapped, and I'm talking with the radiation therapist over the loudspeaker. And I was sort of, just musing to myself and thinking, hey, they have this PSMA PET scan where they inject a radio tracer and it binds to the cell wall of cancerous prostate cells. I'm like, what if you could combine that radio tracer with some sort of chemotherapy or other drug and basically use the radio tracer as a delivery mechanism for the therapeutic drug? And the radiation therapist said, hey, that sounds like a great idea. About 8 minutes later, I hop out of the linear accelerator, come walking out, and she hands me a piece of paper and says, hey, Dr. Erickson wanted you to have this. So Dr. Erickson was my radiation oncologist. I don't know if she overheard me or if the radiation therapist mentioned it to her, but in the time that I was in the linear accelerator, she pulled up a study of exactly what I'm talking about, where they're looking at that kind of treatment for metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer patients. And if that study proves efficacious, then that could become the standard of care. And once it becomes the standard of care for that, down the road a few years, it's possible it becomes the standard of care for earlier stages of prostate cancer. And so, again, one of the things that helps me keep going and helps me not, break under the weight of this diagnosis is the knowledge that there are lots of really, really, really smart people around the world working on this disease. And, even if my treatment isn't curative, if I get 3 or 5 years before recurrence, there will be treatment pathways that are available in 3 to 5 years that aren't even a, that aren't available right now. And that may give me a shot at potentially, whether it's getting cured or whether it's going another 3 or 5 years. And in that time, again, new medicine will become available. And so, the personal care and attention that I've received from the Multi-D clinic, from CPDR and from radiation oncology at Walter Reed have been phenomenal. My main concerns are with primary medicine. I think there's still too many primary care doctors that simply follow the USPSTF guidelines when it comes to screening. And because of that, prostate cancer diagnoses and advanced prostate cancer diagnoses have risen over the last decade since they changed the guidelines from 40 to 50. If I could wave a wand and change one thing, I would adjust the recommendations and have primary care physicians begin all primary care physicians begin talking with their patients about prostate cancer screening beginning at age 40. Doesn't mean everyone needs to get screened at age 40, but it means that that discussion should start then.
Yeah.
And if you're in a high-risk group, maybe you get screened right away. If you're not in a high-risk group and you have no family history, maybe you wait till 50 at that point. But, you know, have the conversation, have the doctors kind of start helping us get educated, and then I think we can make good informed decisions. You know, like I said before, it's important for us
Of
to be
course,
our own number one advocate.
man.
And, you know, this isn't necessarily a primary care anecdote, but just talking about advocating for your own healthcare. I remember, you know, one of my first days in radiotherapy, it was extremely difficult. We'd had a snowstorm here in DC. And so the hospital had opened 2 hours late because it wasn't safe for people to be on the roads before that. So because of that, the radiation oncology schedule was disrupted. And, you know, you had all the patients with appointments from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. coming in at the same time as the patients with 9 a.m. appointments. So it was a lot more crowded. And it was my first couple of days. And I was trying to figure out how to hydrate enough to have a full bladder for my radiotherapy session without being overhydrated and losing control. At the same time, you know, the radiotherapists are trying to accommodate that surge of patients and get everyone through as quickly as possible. So, you know, they probably were a little more businesslike than they normally are. And it was a really challenging day for me. I was super emotional. And at one point, one of the therapists walked up to me and said, you know, hey, are you okay? And, you know, I think as men, as military men, we typically say, yep, everything's fine. And I kind of lost it. I said, no. I started crying. And I just shared my frustrations about like, this is hard. And like, I need a little more empathy for me right now because I'm dealing with some stuff. And she was super empathetic, gave me a hug, reassured me that, you know, she and all the other therapists cared about my radiation treatment and my emotional well-being, and she helped me through a difficult time. You know, I could have kept struggling and tried to do it myself like I normally do, but I'm really happy that I spoke up and explained why I was frustrated. And, you know, I think most patients are afraid of complaining because, you know, everyone's like, well, if I complain too much, am I going to get the same care? And like the answer is yes, you're going to get the same care because they're professionals, but it's an understandable fear that patients have. And you know, it's okay to complain. You know, like I complain's not necessarily a great word, but it's okay, and you absolutely should advocate for yourself. And again, that goes back to, you know, bring a friend and have them advocate for you too, because sometimes, you know, you may not be able to advocate for yourself because of the situation. And so having that wife, having that friend, having that partner there with you to say, hey, you know, this isn't right, or he needs X and you need to do that. It's okay and it's good.
Well, first I want to commend you for, you know, the courage to say, I'm not okay. Because you're right. As men, we have very few spaces where we are allowed to say, hey, I need some help and I'm not okay. And I want to commend the staff there for, you know, showing the empathy that we expect. So one of the things, you know, that we talk a lot about on the health equity team here at Zero is, you know, helping to think through what are the tools that men need, but especially Black men need to ex get and expect equity as they are navigating care. And so I think for many of us, we may not necessarily want to, you know, be vulnerable and sort of say when we need help, But also, you know, when we have those instances when we can be vulnerable and the healthcare delivery system shows up as its best self as well to show that empathy, then it gives us courage to do it again and again and again, and it becomes a
And
natural part.
yeah, and I mean it is tough because like even with this integrated approach, you're still dealing with a lot of different specialties. You're dealing with urology, you're dealing with radiation oncology. For my ADT, I have daily meds, so I have to go to the pharmacy for that and deal with the pharmacy. You got to deal with the laboratory for your quarterly blood draws. If you need scans or anything else, you got to go not to radiation oncology, but to regular radiation or to nuclear medicine for those scans. And so, like, as great as I think Walter Reed is, with any hospital, and I'm sure every other patient has experienced this too, there are little seams between all those different specialties. And when if you go over to the pharmacy and, for example, my doctor prescribed Cialis for post-surgical therapy, and the dosage is different than what they give men for Cialis for erectile dysfunction. So the pharmacist initially rejected the prescription that the doctor put in. So then, you got to circle around and get the and go back to your urologist and have him go back to the pharmacy and explain, no, this is the correct dosage and this is why I'm prescribing it. And so, little things like that are always going to be frustrating, and you got to speak up and advocate for yourself. Otherwise, you'll be waiting for hours at the pharmacy, and then they still won't have what you want.
Well, and two, I think your description is a good one in terms of, saying there are these seams between these, parts of the process. And unfortunately, many of us can fall through those seams if we, are not, maybe we're having a bad day, or maybe, just the weight of all of it is just, so overwhelming. And if we don't have, a good support system around us, we may fall through and then stay falling through, and not sort of come back out to continue that journey. So my last question is focused on how we can support you to amplify your message. So what can organizations like Zero do to help raise awareness generally, but especially among Black men?
Sure. So, I think number one is we have to do better as men and as Black men about discussing this disease. I didn't know it before my diagnosis, but Black men are more likely to develop prostate cancer and are more likely to die from prostate cancer than any other ethnic group. I didn't know before my diagnosis, and had I known, I'd like to think I would have been more insistent with my primary care provider that I'd be screened at a much earlier age. So podcasts like this are great, and the more community awareness that we can raise, the better. I think partnering with government health departments and healthcare systems in majority minority communities, which I know Zero also does, will help too. Ultimately, though, Black men have to become comfortable talking about our medical conditions with each other and sharing our experiences with others. I don't know how you'd reach every barbershop in the country, but if I had a conversation with survivors at a barbershop in my 20s and 30s, back when I still had enough hair to go to the barber, that awareness would have helped me. Same with church for church-going folks. And it's frustrating because most days when I would go to radiation, it was me and several other Black men that were all waiting for our turn in the machine. And we all talked about our situation, and almost to a person, everyone was like, "Yeah, I didn't know that there was a family history until after I got diagnosed." Or, one guy said to me, "I didn't know my father had prostate cancer. He called it old man disease." And I think generationally, if the further we go back from a generational perspective, the less inclined people were to talk about their medical conditions. It was something that was private. It was something that, you didn't share with other people. And I think for, for our generation and those younger than us, people are more willing to talk about their conditions. And if every survivor talked openly about their disease with family, friends, and acquaintances, there'd be a lot more people in the Black community that understood how early detection can both save lives and result in earlier and potentially less invasive or traumatic treatment.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for the for those suggestions. You really hit on exactly what we at Zero and, the health equity team with our Black Men's Prostate Cancer Initiative are working towards. That is, talking to much younger men to make sure that we are, aware of prostate cancer and the same stories that or the same story that you shared. So similar to the stories that I've heard as well, where men have said, "I didn't know this relative had prostate cancer," until many, many years later. And so, how do we facilitate that conversation, within families? That is one of our key priorities,
Yeah, I
on our
mean,
health on a health equity team.
sure. And I mean, again, as an example, I found out in, what did I say, 2016 or so that my father had been diagnosed with prostate cancer at in his mid-60s. After my diagnosis, when I was doing my genetic testing and I went back to my dad for a more thorough family history, I discovered that his younger brother was diagnosed with prostate cancer at age 54. So, again, had I known about that years earlier, that would have informed my discussion with my primary care physician and, again, might have resulted in getting screened at a younger age.
Yes. And so we've talked about on our health equity team, providing men with, some of the tools to have those kinds of conversations, in our families, because sometimes it can be hard to bring up some of these issues without, some good tools and, how to direct the conversation. And like you said, for older generations, the healthcare delivery system was an even less trustworthy partner, to many of the folks older. So it can be quite challenging to have and continue those conversations.
Right.
So I
And
want to say, nope, go ahead.
well, oh, sorry. I was going to say too, for those of us from non-intact nuclear families, getting that family history can also be very challenging.
Yes. So the assumption that all families are intact families is also a critical component of that conversation, and recognizing that some of that information just may not necessarily be available if we don't have
Right.
contact with those members of our family. So Eric, I just want to thank you again for taking the time today to sit down with me to talk about your prostate cancer journey, for helping to raise awareness about this disease. We really appreciate you working to make your voice heard and partnering with Zero to increase awareness about prostate cancer. And I'm sure the folks listening at home or wherever they may be listening appreciate hearing your story.
Well, thanks very much, Reggie. It's been a pleasure speaking with you also, and I hope my story helps others.
Thank you for listening to Prostate Cancer Uncensored, a podcast produced by Zero. To download more podcasts, head over to zerocancer.org.